Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. Secretary of State John Kerry says Gulf Cooperation Council foreign ministers agree the Iran nuclear deal will contribute to their region's security once it is fully implemented. He said the two sides also agreed to establish working groups that would seek to expand regional security through cooperation on issues including intelligence sharing, special forces training, and maritime security. Appearing with Kerry, Qatari Foreign Minister Khaled Al-Attari offered a cautious endorsement of the Iran nuclear agreement, calling it the best option. Top Qatari diplomat added, Gulf Arabs ultimately would like to see a ban on nuclear weapons in the entire Middle East. Greek stocks dropped sharply Monday when the Athens Stock Exchange opened for the first time in 5 weeks. The exchange index lost nearly 23% in the opening moments of trading. Shares steadily regained some ground, with the index down less than 19% after 2 hours. The government closed the stock exchange in late June when it also shut down banks and imposed limits on money withdrawals. Greece reached an agreement on a new bailout with the European Union and International Monetary Fund last month and reopened the banks on July 20th. There was no consensus Monday on how soon talks to conclude the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Pact could be revived after the 12 parties failed to reach a deal at a meeting last week held in Hawaii. The timing really is a challenge at this point, really driven by electoral politics, Asia Trade Center Executive Director Deborah Elms told VOA via Skype. A Canadian general election is scheduled for October 19th, and campaigning began Sunday. This is VOA News. A new survey in the United States shows by a 2-to-1 margin Americans oppose the international accord to restrain Iran's nuclear development program and think it would make the world less safe. The public opinion poll released Monday by Quinnipiac University in Connecticut showed registered U.S. voters by a 57% to 28% margin oppose the deal the United States and five other world powers finalized last month with Tehran. The pact bars Iran from building a nuclear weapon in the coming years in exchange for lifting Western and United Nations sanctions on Iran that have hobbled its economy. By a similar 58 to 30% margin, the voters said the deal would make the world less safe. U.S. Congress is in the midst of a 60-day review of the pact and is expected to vote next month on whether to accept it or reject it. The world athletic community is reacting to reports that 146 medals, including 55 golds at the Olympics and at the World Championships between 2001 and 12, were won by athletes with suspicious blood test results. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok.
The president of the International Olympic Committee says there is no solid foundation for the widespread doping allegations. Speaking to reporters at the conclusion of the IOC summit in Kuala Lumpur, Thomas Bach Monday urged patience until the outcome of an investigation by the impartial World Anti-Doping Agency.
Now it's in the hands of WADA as the competent center of both sports and governments to deal with this, and we have full confidence in their procedure.
The president of the International Association of Athletics Federations told IOC members Monday that behind the doping abuse report is a campaign to redistribute medals. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the killing of a UN peacekeeper in the Central African Republic who died Sunday after being attacked by gunmen in the country's capital. The UN said troops from MINUSCA, its mission in the Central African Republic, were conducting a search to arrest a suspected criminal in Bangui when the armed group attacked, killing the peacekeeper and injuring 8 others. Secretary General deplores in the strongest terms attacks against United Nations peacekeepers and calls for swift action to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice, Mr. Bond's spokesman said. The UN force took over from an African Union peacekeeping mission nearly a year ago. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
Well, I think more and more across this country, people are becoming aware of the plight of animals, whether they're animals languishing in zoos or other captive facilities, animals languishing in the pet trade. And in the United States, we do have a pretty serious problem with primates being kept as pets.
That's Adam Roberts, CEO of Born Free USA. He praises new U.S. legislation to give refuge to abused primates. Details coming up.
Also in the news, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza has condemned the assassination of the country's former intelligence chief yesterday. And Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni picked up nomination forms that will allow him to run for president in 2016.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Sierra Leone, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza has condemned the assassination of the country's former intelligence chief yesterday. Lieutenant General Adolphe Nshimirimana was killed with his two bodyguards when their vehicle was hit by two rockets. It happened in the capital's Kamenge neighborhood. The attackers also fired automatic weapons at the vehicle. Nshimirimana had been considered the president's right-hand man. He's suspected of playing a role in putting down an attempted coup in May. Mr. Nkurunziza says he wants the killers arrested within 10 days. The president was reelected last month, and there's been tension and ongoing violence in Burundi since he announced his bid for a third term in April. The opposition called the move unconstitutional. About 160,000 Burundians have fled to neighboring countries since April. The chairperson of the AU Commission, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, says she is horrified by the assassination.
Last Friday, Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni picked up nomination forms that will allow him to stand for president in 2016. That same day, his political rival, Amam Mbabazi, defected from the nation's ruling political party, saying he will run as an independent. Elizabeth Polat has more from Kampala.
Last week, the headquarters for the nation's ruling party, the NRM, was packed with supporters who waited with anticipation for President Yoweri Museveni. Arriving around midday, Mr. Museveni greeted the crowd cheerfully, picking up his forms and confirming his place as the presidential flag bearer of the NRM. Mr. Museveni will be standing for his fifth term in office. He says it was a decision that he and the historical members of the NRM made together. Mr. Museveni will be running uncontested within the NRM party. That's because his anticipated rival, Amama Mbabazi, decided to run as an independent. Mbabazi says that while he's still a member of the NRM party, the party needs to re-examine itself, accusing it of obstructing his candidature. Mr. Museveni's decision to run again comes on the heels of President Obama's recent remarks at the African Union that nobody should be president for life. Former Vice President of Uganda, Gilbert Bukenya, agrees, saying Mr. Museveni should know better.
He must know the consequences. He must know that we are not going to allow dictatorship. He must know that the people are tired of a long stay leader who used to tell others that they have stayed for a long time when they never even stayed for more than 10 years.
However, many credit Mr. Museveni's leadership for Uganda's stability and economic growth. Longtime supporter and deputy presidential assistant Duncan Abigaba explains why.
People credit his peace and security credentials because there is no single time in this country, in the history of this country, where there has been this peace. So people are comfortable. People are saying, well, we may not have money in the pocket, but Museveni has brought the peace. I can use this peace to do whatever I want. So Museveni should stay.
While Museveni's presidential bid is clear, Mbabazi's remains murky. There is speculation that he will join the Democratic Alliance, an umbrella group of opposition parties. The alliance says it is open to Mbabazi joining, although they stress he will still have to work hard to become the Democratic Alliance's flag bearer. Elizabeth Pola for VOA, Kampala, Uganda.
Nigeria's military says it's freed nearly 180 hostages being held by Boko Haram militants. It says 100 of the hostages were children. The military also reports the capture of a Boko Haram commander. The French news agency says the rescue operation took place yesterday near Olare, about 70 kilometers south of the Borno state capital of Maiduguri. Nigeria's military also says airstrikes on a forest region near the Cameroon border killed many militants. In related news, an army spokesman says Boko Haram had converted an abandoned chemistry lab at Digwa College of Education in Borno State into a bomb-making factory. Nigerian forces retook Digwa last week. Also, Benin will send 800 troops to be part of a regional force to fight Boko Haram. They'll join troops from Nigeria, Chad, Cameroon, and Niger.
A Tunisian man has been arrested for allegedly trying to smuggle 360 migrants into Europe. Police in Sicily say the Eritrean and Sudanese migrants were packed aboard a fishing boat. AP reports they were rescued by an Italian tugboat and brought to the port of Pozzola yesterday. Police say the 21-year-old Tunisian man had been recruited by Libyan traffickers. The migrants reportedly paid the traffickers $1,500 apiece. Also, Reuters reports that a 27-year-old Moroccan man suffocated while being smuggled to Spain in a suitcase. Authorities say the suitcase was found in the trunk of a car that arrived by ferry at the port of Alamaria. The car was owned by the dead man's brother, who's been charged with murder. Reuters says the brother had called for help, but emergency medical personnel were not able to revive the man.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib, 12 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. Burundi's president, Pierre Nkurunziza, has condemned the assassination of a country's former intelligence chief yesterday. Ugandan president Yoweri Museveni picked up nomination forms that will allow him to run for president in 2016. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon condemned the killing of a UN peacekeeper in the Central African Republic who died yesterday after being attacked by gunmen in the country's capital. The UN said troops from MINUSCA, its mission in the CAR, were conducting a search to arrest a suspected criminal in Bangui when the armed group attacked, killing the peacekeeper and injuring eight others. The Secretary General deplores in the strongest terms attacks against United Nations peacekeepers and calls for swift action to bring the perpetrators of this crime to justice. Mr. Bond's spokesman said he further calls on all armed groups to respect the impartiality of MINUSCA. The UN force took over from an AU peacekeeping mission nearly a year ago with a mandate to protect civilians and support a political transition in the CAR, which is due to hold elections in October. The crisis there began in 2013 when predominantly Muslim rebels ousted President Francois Bozizé's government and committed widespread rights abuses. In response, Christian militias formed, setting off sectarian fighting that pushed hundreds of thousands of Muslim civilians to neighboring countries.
A second American has been accused by Zimbabwean authorities of illegally killing a lion. The announcement follows Zimbabwe's request that Washington extradite Minnesota dentist Walter Palmer for the alleged poaching of a rare black maned lion. VOA's Victor Beattie reports the killings have generated an international debate over trophy hunting.
Zimbabwe's accused Pennsylvania medical doctor Jan Casimir Seski of illegally killing a lion near the Hwangi National Park in April with a bow and arrow. Landowner and safari organizer Headman Sabanda has been arrested in the case. Zimbabwe's National Parks and Wildlife Management Authority has suspended the hunting of lions, leopards, and elephants in the Hwangi area. Last week, news of the killing of a well-known black-maned lion named Cecil by Walter Palmer sparked international outrage on social media. In a statement Tuesday, Palmer said he believed he was acting legally when he killed Cecil July 1st. He said he used professional guides and secured all the proper permits. Palmer's guide, Theo Bronkhorst, faces trial in Zimbabwe Wednesday on a charge of failing to prevent an illegal hunt. In an interview with the French press agency, he denied allegations they lured the wounded lion out of Hwange and killed him with a gun. He has pleaded not guilty. Appearing Sunday on U.S. television, conservationist Jack Hanna, director emeritus of the Columbus, Ohio Zoo, says the lion population has dwindled dramatically in the past 70 years.
In 1947, when I was born, there were about 450,000 lions. In the mid-70s, when my kids were born, there were about 100,000. Today, there are less than 30,000.
Hanna was asked if it's time to put an end to so-called trophy hunting, the selective hunting of wild game animals in which part of the slain animal, such as the skin, antlers, or head, is kept as a hunting trophy.
I think issues have to be looked at, yes. I'm not saying an end to everything. The predator relationship to prey is messed up in a lot of places, so you have to work on that. However, I think this issue has to be looked at immediately, considering the loss of the lions to 30,000 now. We've got to take some of these animals that might be plentiful somewhere and put these animals in other areas where they need these animals.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it is investigating the Palmer case, and comments have flooded the Twitter hashtag Cecil Lion. The dentist has not been seen in public since the story made news last week. His office is closed, and he has reportedly been the object of death threats. Friday, U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner declined to discuss Zimbabwe's request that Palmer be sent there for trial.
I can more broadly talk about extradition and how that process works, if it's helpful. They are received by the Department of State through diplomatic channels, and state works closely with the Department of Justice to determine whether an incoming extradition request meets the requirements of the applicable treaty. Department of Justice then presents the request to a U.S. court that determines whether the individual is extraditable. After those judicial proceedings have been completed, it's the Secretary of State who makes the final decision on whether to extradite an individual to another country. And obviously, humanitarian concerns and the ability of an individual to receive a fair trial may be considered at this stage of the process.
Jen's David Olin, a Cornell University law professor, says Palmer could be extraditable if what is alleged in Zimbabwe can also be considered a crime here in the United States, punishable by at least 1 year in prison. But Olin says there are further legal tools Palmer can use.
Well, I think that there's two levels. The first is he can lobby the Justice Department and he can lobby the State Department, or his lawyers can, and ask them to block the extradition request and to not comply with it. But assuming that the State Department and the Justice Department decide that they want to comply with the extradition request, even if that happens, Palmer's lawyers still have an avenue available to them, which is they can fight extradition after he's been arrested in the United States. The process for him is that he would be arrested, he'd be brought to a local court. At that point, instead of waiving extradition, he could contest it, and he could say that there's some defect in the process.
In Washington, U.S. Senator Robert Menendez has introduced legislation called Conserving Ecosystems by Ceasing the Importation of Large, or CECL, Animal Trophies Act. It would expand import bans to species proposed for listing as threatened or endangered, as well as those already considered endangered. Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Victor. Well, new U.S. legislation has been introduced to provide a lifetime refuge for primates that have been physically and psychologically traumatized and are unable to be returned to the wild. The measure aims to protect primates held in captivity or forced to perform in shows that could be put to death when no longer considered useful. The Sanctuary Regulatory Fairness Act was introduced last week in Congress. The animal welfare and conservation group Born Free USA praises the legislation. Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and Born Free Foundation. He explains how the legislation would allow for humane care for primates here and abroad.
The Sanctuary Regulatory Fairness Act, which was introduced by Representatives Elmers of North Carolina and DeFazio of Oregon, and then in the Senate by Senator Cassidy of Louisiana, is very narrowly crafted legislation that has global impact to basically fix some Centers for Disease Control regulations that currently prohibit the importation of primates if they're for rescue and sanctuary care in a humane facility here in the United States. Currently, individuals can import primates if they're they're for zoos or circuses, those licensed exhibitors, or for universities and biomedical research, but not for lifetime care in a sanctuary. And so we feel very strongly at Born Free USA that that humane aspect of primate importation should be facilitated as well.
Why is there a need for this humane act?
Well, simply because we have the facilities here in the United States to provide care for primates in need overseas. And so it's, I think, a tragedy that we're prohibited legally from doing so unless we register as a licensed exhibitor like a zoo. There are some sanctuaries that are, but for example, the Born Free USA Primate Sanctuary down in Texas is not. We want to be completely closed off to the public and provide true lifetime sanctuary care for these animals. We've got more than 600 of them there. And so currently we are prohibited from bringing these animals into the country, and we do get requests all the time to do so.
What's motivated U.S. representatives to become involved in finding a refuge for abused primates?
Well, I think more and more across this country, people are becoming aware of the plight of animals, whether they're animals languishing in zoos or other captive facilities, animals languishing in the pet trade. And in the United States, we do have a pretty serious problem with primates being kept as pets. And we're actually at Born Free pursuing legislation to try and stop the trade in primates as pets as well. But more and more across the country, you have sanctuaries that are giving lifetime care to these animals, chimpanzees, macaques, tigers, that are kept as pets and that are in the captive trade. And since it falls on us in the sanctuary movement to take care of these animals, I think we want to make sure that we can give them the best, most humane life possible. And right now, there's no alternative. So some of these animals overseas that can't be imported into the United States are going to go to other substandard facilities, are going to go into the pet trade, or might be euthanized. So the members of Congress that are pursuing this legislation recognize it's the humane thing to do and that there's a groundswell of support across the country for this kind of action.
Also, you mentioned that some U.S. sanctuaries, they do have the capacity to provide humane care for primates in countries overseas. So how will this legislation even help that more?
Well, I think in two ways. One is that this legislation will make sure that all sanctuaries that are certified by the Secretary of Health and Human Services can bring in the animals. As I say, Born Free USA, we don't have to have that kind of permit from the government, but we are an accredited sanctuary, accredited by the Global Federation of Animal Sanctuaries. This means that we don't allow commercial trade in the animals that we care for. We provide them lifetime humane care. We don't take them off the premises or allow breeding. So we are what would be called a certified or accredited sanctuary, but under current CDC rules, we're not able to bring in the animals in need. It could be vervet monkeys in Jordan, or a Barbary macaque or snow monkey from Canada, or baboons from Kenya, Kuwait, Uruguay. And we are sort of uniquely situated at Born Free Sanctuary to care for these animals, so that's why this legislation is so important.
Are there any species of primates that are in danger of extinction that would be saved by this act?
Well, there could be. I mean, there are chimpanzee facilities in the United States. In South Carolina, there's a really amazing group that called the International Primate Protection League that cares for gibbons. So there are some species that are found in international trade and are in need of rescue. What we find more and more is that with chimpanzees specifically, there are a number of sanctuaries in Africa that are fully equipped to care for these animals. Of course, they also need financial and other logistical support. But nonetheless, we think it's these other species of monkeys, macaques, baboons, etc., that really are going to need the care from this act rather than the more endangered great apes who could be cared for in Africa at existing facilities.
Adam Roberts is CEO of Born Free USA and Born Free Foundation. He spoke with me from Washington.
Greece and its European creditors continue to work out the terms of a deal to prevent Greece from defaulting on its debt. The new plan includes unpopular reforms such as cutting pensions and public employment and increasing taxes. Critics of the European Union's plan want to end years of tough austerity measures for Greece and provide the country with debt relief. Among those watching the negotiations are leaders and opinion makers of Africa. The continent experienced its own austerity measures imposed by the International Monetary Fund in the 1980s and 90s. VOA's William Eagle has more on the story.
Elizabeth Sideropoulos says Africans have learned that policymakers must balance belt tightening with social justice.
While, particularly in the Greek case, a degree of austerity is important and is necessary, at what point do you actually have to say to yourself, well, the outcomes that we were hoping to achieve are actually, in fact, destroying the very patient or the very country that it's hoping to help.
On the other hand, she says developing countries are themselves contributing financial support to the IMF, and as much as they recall the pain of austerity on their own economies, they would not want to see what they consider to be a developed European country get special treatment.
The IMF should not be seen as being quite willing to pump money into economies that are industrialized and almost not while adopting different criteria or implementing it in different ways when it comes to developing countries.
Another lesson from the Greek crisis is the difficulty of establishing an EU-like monetary union in Africa that includes scores of countries at very different levels of economic development. Kenyan economist James Shikwati of the Inter-Region Economic Network in Nairobi says they would likely have the same problem as Greece, which struggles to meet strict European Union rules on keeping debt levels low as a percentage of gross domestic product. Shikwati says African governments have the same problems as Greece, curbing debt and containing expenditures. These issues and the dispute among European Union members themselves on budgetary rules are giving Africans second thoughts about the continent's own financial integration. Already, he says, African governments are failing to carry out less ambitious agreements and rules to ease border controls and to reduce restrictions that promote trade. He says a monetary union based on the EU is a romantic idea that ignores reality.
If we look at what's going on in Europe, yeah, I think it gives us warning signals that we need not rush into monetary union purely on the romantic or the aesthetic aspect of one Africa. We need at least to have a hard look in terms of how we manage our own resources. Because with Kenya, for instance, it still has a big challenge just accounting for its public funds. Now, what will become of the continent or the region where we have a united front of countries that are poor managers of their funds, and then you put them in one bag? I think that would be even a big disaster than what we are witnessing in Europe.
Shikwati says the example of Greece is also leading Africans to reconsider debt relief deals that focus on imports and trade, especially with creditor nations. He says they often require debtor states to purchase goods and services from lenders. They do not, he says, encourage development in debtor countries.
In terms of export and import, you know, we've had this argument that there's an attempt to turn the whole of Africa into a huge supermarket, a shopping mall, which means import everything, produce nothing, export less. Again, if you look at the history or the challenges Greece also facing, there's the argument that Greece has been importing twice as much as they export.
African economists say their own governments must have a greater say in structuring loan agreements with the international lenders. Many in the African press approved of the recent Greek referendum, in which voters disapproved of the EU's offer of continuing austerity. A press release from the Congress of South African Trade Unions said the EU deal would suck the blood out of the Greek people, and that the voters had shown Africa an example of an alternative path to development that serves the people and their societal needs. Others say that it's not clear that Greece has charted a new direction for developing countries, including those in Africa. Despite Greek voters' rejection of continued austerity, the New Deal looks a lot like those agreed to in the past. I'm William Eagle in Washington.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza condemns the assassination of the country's former intelligence chief yesterday. Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni picked up nomination forms that will allow him to run for president in 2016. And Nigeria's military says it's freed nearly 180 hostages being held by Boko Haram militants. Coming up, we'll have music from Sierra Leone. And in our feature segment, women military veterans in South Sudan call on the government to recognize their service to the nation. I'm Kim Lewis with Yahya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. And of course, it's time now for the sunny side of sports. With filling in for Sunny this week is our own Jonah Haskell. Welcome, Jonah.
Thank you, Kim. We begin today with the International Olympic Committee, which has just accepted its newest member. On Sunday, South Sudan was officially recognized by the IOC as the 206th member of the Olympic movement. Members of South Sudan's Olympic Committee were emotional after the announcement at the meeting in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, and the head of the committee, Wilson Deng Kwairot, spoke about the pride that this historic moment brings to his country.
It's a pride to my country to be this, accepted in this wonderful organization. The other one is that being a member of the International Olympic Committee will allow us to send a team to the next Olympics, which is going to be in Rio de Janeiro in 2016. We are going to.
That South Sudanese Olympic team will most likely include four runners, including marathoner Gwor Marial. Marial participated in the marathon event at the 2012 London Olympics, but because South Sudan had not yet been recognized by the IOC, he had to run under the Olympic flag as an independent athlete. Gwor is very excited about the chance to compete for South Sudan officially and says that he will use the announcement as motivation.
I was crying when the announcement came, but it's a great feeling. It's a relief, and now I know what I will be working for. I know now I'm going to be going to the world to the Olympic, and my athletes, the South Sudanese athletes, also they know they will be going to the world championship for South Sudan. So it's great motivation, and it boosts our energy to focus on training.
The South Sudanese Olympic Committee also hopes to send basketball, volleyball, and handball teams to Rio de Janeiro in the summer of 2016. But the civil war in the country has made it near impossible for organized sports to exist, with most of South Sudan's athletes doing their training in Kenya. Yet officials remain optimistic about the program's future. Says Kwairot of Young South Sudanese, "We're going to arm them with sports instead of with guns." And staying on the topic of the Olympics, the world athletic community is reacting to reports that 146 medals, including 55 golds at the Olympics and at the World Championships between 2001 and 2012, were won by athletes with suspicious blood test results. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from our Southeast Asia Bureau in Bangkok that various sporting organizations are calling for a thorough investigation.
The president of the International Olympic Committee says there is no solid foundation for the widespread doping allegations. Speaking to reporters at the conclusion of the IOC summit in Kuala Lumpur, Thomas Bach Monday urged patience until the outcome of an investigation by the impartial World Anti-Doping Agency.
The IOC will follow its zero-tolerance policy and will do everything to protect the clean athletes. First of all, now it's in the hands of WADA as the competent center of both sports and governments to deal with this, and we have full confidence in their procedure.
The chief of WADA, Craig Reedy, calls the allegations wild and wide and says the reports aired by a German broadcaster and published in a British newspaper Sunday will once again shake the foundation of clean athletes worldwide. The media outlets say they obtained access to the results of 12,000 blood tests from 5,000 athletes in the IAAF database after a leak by a whistleblower. More than 800 of the athletes recorded one or more abnormal test results, defined as a result that had less than one chance in 100 of being natural, the president of the International Association of Athletics Federations told IOC members Monday that behind the doping abuse report is a campaign to redistribute medals. Russia's sports minister, Vitaly Mutko, also suggests there is an ulterior motive behind the allegations. Russian athletes had by far the most suspicious results, followed distantly by Ukraine, Morocco, Spain, Kenya, and Turkey. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
This is Larry Zamude, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 80.9, Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja, Nigeria. Let's talk to you about Brilla FM. It's Nigeria's only sports station, of course, with partner, the VOA. VOA! And so you can listen to Sunny Side of Sports on 80.9 Brilla FM, Lagos and Abuja. Keep listening, Africa, and enjoy Sunny Side of Sports on Brilla.
Thank you, Steve. There was a lot of African football action taking place this weekend across the continent. Our Nightline Africa sportsman Segun Adeyemi joins us now with news on that and other sporting events from the weekend.
Good evening, Africa. All but two of the qualifiers for the 2015 CAF Under-23 Football Championship have now emerged. The qualifiers are Algeria, Egypt, South Africa, Tunisia, and Zambia. They join host Senegal, which qualified automatically. Whereas Algeria picked the final ticket last month, Egypt, South Africa, Tunisia and Zambia advanced this weekend. In their third round return leg matches played this weekend, Egypt qualified 6-1 on aggregates after beating Uganda 2-1 in Kampala. South Africa qualified 4-1 on aggregates after using home advantage to beat Zimbabwe 3-0. Tunisia advanced 2-1 on aggregates after beating fellow North African Morocco 2-0 in Rades, while Zambia qualified 4-3 on penalties after playing goalless in the two legs with Ivory Coast. The remaining two slots in the eight-team final will be filled later today, Sunday, when Nigeria takes on host Congo in Pointe Noire and Mali hosts Gabon. The three top teams in Senegal will represent Africa at the 2016 Summer Olympics Men's Football Tournament in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. The fourth place team will enter into a playoff with an Asian side. In the 2015 CAF Women's Olympic Qualifying Tournament, Cameroon has joined Ivory Coast in the fourth and final qualifying round. On Saturday, Cameroon reached the final round of the away goal rule after tying 3-3 on aggregate with Ghana. The first leg ended 1-1 and the second leg 2-2. For its part, Ivory Coast reached the final round after walking over Zimbabwe, which withdrew after failing to secure the necessary funds to travel for the first leg. Both Cameroon and Ivory Coast will clash for one of the two African slots at the 2016 Rio Olympics Women's Football. The teams vying for the second slot will be determined later today, Sunday, when Kenya hosts South Africa and Nigeria travels to Equatorial Guinea. And from Malawi comes the report that Ernest Mutawali has been appointed coach of the country's senior national football team. The former midfielder was banned for life for leaving Malawi in 1984 to play in the league in apartheid-era South Africa, which was then excluded from international sports. Malawi's next international is away at Swaziland in the Nations Cup qualifiers next month, after which it plays neighbor Tanzania over two legs in October as it begins its bid to qualify for the next World Cup in Russia in 2018. Staying in Southern Africa, South African businessman and former political prisoner Tokyo Sexwale is considering running for president of World Soccer's governing body, FIFA. His spokesman said Sexwale had been approached to put his name forward as a candidate for the FIFA presidency by several highly placed personalities within the football fraternity. He is in the process of consulting, following which he will then make up his mind, the spokesman said. A close friend of the late former South African President Nelson Mandela, who he spent 13 years with in the Robben Island prison, Sexwale was a member of the African National Congress and was a post-apartheid government minister before moving into business. UEFA President Michel Platini has emerged as the early frontrunner in the race to replace Sepp Blatter as head of FIFA. Soccer's governing body was thrown into turmoil in May when 14 sports marketing executives and soccer officials, including several from FIFA, were indicted in the United States on bribery, money laundering, and wire fraud charges. Finally, following the conclusion of the national trials, Athletics Kenya has selected 46 athletes to compete at the IAAF World Championships, Beijing 2015, later this month. Three-time world champion and double Olympic champion Ezekiel Kemboi only finished fourth in the steeplechase at the trials, but will make use of his wild card as the defending world champion. World champions Asbel Kiprop and Yunis Som also had wild card, but they guaranteed their places on the team by winning in Nairobi, Kenya, this weekend. Two-time world marathon champion Edna Kiplagat was among the names announced earlier this year on the provisional marathon teams for Beijing. World record holder Dennis Kimeto and Wilson Kipsang also feature on the men's team. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos.
Thank you, Segun. And a quick update on those two Olympic qualifiers that took place on Sunday. Nigeria drew Congo 0-0 to take the 2-1 aggregate win, while Mali beat Gabon 2-0. Both teams are now qualified for the final qualifying tournament in Senegal in November.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
The Quicken Loans National Golf Tournament finished off on Sunday, with American Troy Merritt taking the first place prize with a score of 18 under. Justin Rose, who won the tournament last year, tied for fourth at 12 under par, while the tournament's host, Tiger Woods, tied for 18th at 8 under. South African Retief Goosen, who is one of the early leaders, finished at 4 under, tied with his countryman Ernie Els for 46th place. The final major of 2015 is coming up soon, as the PGA Championship begins on August 13th in the northern U.S. city of Kohler, Wisconsin. Jordan Spieth will be looking to win his third major of the year, although he will fall short on his quest to win the Grand Slam after losing the British Open to Zach Johnson last month. World number one Rory McIlroy is doubtful after tearing a ligament in his ankle earlier this year. The Northern Irish golfer already missed the British Open and the WGC Bridgestone tournament due to the injury. McIlroy was also the 2014 champion of the PGA Championship, and he'll be looking to get back from his injury as soon as possible. That does it for the sunny side of sports. I'm Jonah Haskell. Right. Back to Kim Lewis and Yahias Wuhib.
Okay, thank you, Jonah. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, women military veterans in South Sudan calling on the government to recognize their service to the nation. And next, refining artificial limbs, including the most complex of them, the human hand. But first, some music. Here is Alonso of Sierra Leone with Dream Alive.
Oh, 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 oh. Dream Alive. See the world we are living in, no man is an island. We all got our own dreams, and we all got the chance. I see the chance to achieve it, if we do believe it. Yeah. I say, please don't give up now, say yes, you can do it. Oh, we all know, nothing good is gonna come easy. So do ya just be strong and work hard, one day you'll make it. No matter what you're going through, face your dreams, do ya, don't run away. Believe that tomorrow's gonna be a brighter day. Please don't give up now. No matter what you're going through, face your dreams, do ya, don't run away. Believe that tomorrow's gonna be a brighter day. Please don't give up now. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, no matter what the dream is, you can achieve it, if you keep that dream alive, alive, dream alive, I'm keeping my dream alive, alive, no matter what you're going.
going through, just keep that dream alive, alive, dream alive. I'm keeping my dreams alive, alive. Please don't give up now, just keep that dream alive. You can achieve it if you believe it. No matter what the dream is, if you want people believing you, then you gotta believe in yourself. If you want them trusting you, you need to trust in yourself. I say, please don't be afraid, afraid of the challenges you face. And just be ready, ready, ready all the time for you to win the race. We all know nothing good is gonna come easy. But just be strong and work hard, one day you'll make it. Me, I believe in my dreams, and I know for sure that I can do it. I'm lyrically, physically, mentally fit. I stand up tall and I know easy to defeat. You can achieve it if you believe it. No matter what the dream is, yes, you can do it. If you keep that dream alive, alive, dream alive. I'm keeping my dream alive, alive. No matter what you're going through, just keep that dream alive, alive, dream alive. I'm keeping my dream alive, alive. Please don't give up now, just keep that dream alive. You can be a lawyer, you can be a doctor, you can be a teacher, a tailor, and a trader. You can even be Okada man. You can even be Poda driver. Hey, you can even own a Poyo bar. You can even be a fisherman. Oh, 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 oh. You can even be a policeman. You can even be a soldier man. Man. You can be a city council police. You can even be a prison officer. Hey, hey. Play football like Kwame Kalon. You can even produce music like Sam Borichi. Hey. You can even be a big businessman, a big bomber like Mosire Fadika. Hey. You can even be a politician. We not go chop with money and they give you stories. You can even own a mobile company.
Sierra Leone's Alonzo with Dream Alive.
While many women fought in the long civil war that ultimately led to the creation of an independent South Sudan, now some women military veterans are calling on the government to recognize their service to the nation. In 2013, the women set up a foundation called Katiba Banat, which means Girls Battalion in Arabic. The foundation advocates for the rights of women, particularly those who are currently serving in the military, helps elderly women veterans, and is calling on the government to give women fighters the recognition they deserve. But as Philip Thon Aliyu reports for VOA from Juba, members of Katiba Banat have internal challenges to overcome before they achieve their goals.
Brigadier General Nyankira Atim was at a training camp in Ethiopia for Southern Sudanese Army recruits in 1985 when the founder of the Sudan People Liberation Movement, John Greng, gave women recruits the name Katiba Banat. Nyankir remembers the task assigned to her and other women who fought for the Southern Sudanese cause.
When they are bringing wounded heroes, we are taking care of them. We have our brother, which are trained a nurse, and we were not trained nurse. But we try our level to help them. We wash them, we nurse them, and we clean their places, cooking for them, do everything for them. We've been taking our mission to front line. We did that.
Nyankir says, when South Sudan became an independent nation in 2011, she decided to revive her battalion's legacy. 2 years later, in 2013, she set up the Katiba Banat Foundation.
I formed the foundation because I not our name to be what? To be forgotten. I myself, I love the name of Katiba Banat, even all of us. And they said our name lost. That's why I say, okay, let me form Katiba Banat Foundation.
Second Lieutenant Abai Helen says one of the goals of the Katiba Banat Foundation is to give financial support and moral support to women veterans who fought for freedom for South Sudan.
It will engage also more female soldiers who will come or who are now
join us, like the new female soldiers who have been trained. They will also be part and they are going to be beneficiaries in this foundation of Katiba Barnard.
Abai says that while no women soldiers have reported any serious issues, she suspects that they may be suffering in silence in the army. She says the Katiba Barnard Foundation is there to help women soldiers who may have no one else to turn to. But the foundation depends largely on contributions from individuals and is facing a serious financial shortfall. Deborah Ajor, a national MP from Unity State and the Secretary of Finance for Katiba Barnard, says there is a lack of accountability among those who hold the force string in the foundation. For example, Ajor says several ministers donated funds to the foundation during the recent celebrations of South Sudan's post anniversary of independence. But she says the foundation coordinator, Aguili Chut, has not accounted for all of the money. Chut called a meeting for today at which he planned to update other foundation officials on the Independence Day pledges from ministers and other financial matters. But Ajor says foundation members have been asked not to go to the meeting.
We need her to bring the report. If not, we need her to stop from calling those people. And that is why we said anybody will give her this card for invitation for tomorrow. We as Katiba Barnard, we are not responsible for this occasion.
Chut says she is not trying to swindle the foundation, but she is working hard to ensure the group's prosperity. Chut notes that she works with Nyankir to set up Katiba Barnard in 2013. Chut says she got involved with the foundation to keep the legacy of South Sudan's women freedom fighters alive.
In 2010, before the independence, because I came back from Australia and I talked to my colleague and I said, look, now where is Katiba Barnard anyway? Because Katiba Barnard seemed like disappearing, but the history should not disappear.
Chut says the group is just beginning to get really active this year, and she has so far organized 4 events. Among them was participation in the Independence Day parade by Katiba Barnard members and a group prayer for peace at Juba's Dr. John Gereng Memorial Ground. Both Chut and Nyankir went women veterans of the War of Liberation to have their proper place in historical records for South Sudan. They are also advocating for the current quota that requires 25% of public offices to be held by women to be increased. But they acknowledge that they must learn to work together if they are to have a chance of achieving their common goals. For VOA News, I am Philip Tonaleo in Juba.
Artificial limbs, including the most complex of them, the human hand, are getting more lifelike and useful to constant advances in tiny hydraulic, pneumatic and electric motors called accutators. But now, as VOA's George Puttick reports, scientists in Germany say the future of the prosthetic hand may lie not in motors, but in wires that can remember their shape.
The human hand is one of the most mechanically complex systems in nature, so making an artificial replica is a daunting task. An ideal prosthesis should be light and flexible, with a reasonably powerful grip and controlled by the owner's mind. Presently, prosthetics rely on relatively heavy hydraulic, electric, or pneumatic actuators to flex artificial fingers. But scientists at Germany's Saarland University are experimenting with much lighter fibers made of nickel-titanium alloy that change shape when connected to a source of electricity.
The movement of the hand is done by the wire. This wire, when they are actuated, they contract. And we are able to exploit this contraction to make the finger move. And we can move each phalanx independently.
Bundles of these memory wires could form more powerful yet lightweight artificial muscles and tendons. Their flexing can be controlled independently by measuring the electrical resistance of the wires.
We can monitor the position of the finger without adding any other sensor, only exploiting this embedded feature of the wire.
Scientists believe that with further advances of so-called shape memory alloys, it will be possible to build more natural-looking prosthetic hands.
If you
look down the road to like future prosthesis generations, you would like to see this integrated with the human body in a way that you can actually sense the nerve stimuli and then you can feed that into a microcontroller, which there it will be translated to a corresponding signal to activate the muscle.
Saarland University scientists are now looking into how natural patterns of hand movements could be applied to memory alloy muscles. George Putich, VOA News, Washington.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehi Swuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Jackson Mbunganyi, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The government of The Gambia has released more than 200 prisoners, including 31 jailed for treason for their alleged involvement in efforts to depose the West African nation's long-serving president, Yahya Jammeh. At the same time, several individuals remain arbitrarily detained or missing in the country, including radio journalist Alege Abadoule Cisse, who disappeared on July 17th. President Jammeh announced their release himself in a speech July 24th commemorating his 21 years in office. Among those being released were a former justice minister and former police chief jailed for alleged corruption and drug trafficking, respectively. Those linked to a failed coup in December remain in prison, although several of their family members were freed, officials said. Human rights groups have charged the Gambian government with repressive tactics for stifling political activism and dissent. In December, Gambia's eligibility was suspended for trade benefits under our nation's African Growth and Opportunities Act because of the country's poor record on human rights. The United States notes President Jammeh's decision to pardon and release at least 200 prisoners and welcomes in particular the release, after a lengthy period of detention without charge, family members of the December 30, 2014 coup plotters. We call on the Gambia to respect its human rights obligations and to release all other prisoners currently being held without charges for longer than the 72-hour period established in the Gambia's constitution. Meanwhile, the United States remains deeply concerned about the whereabouts of Mr. Cisse, the missing Gambian radio journalist. He disappeared on July 17th, days after being released from a two-week-long period of arbitrary detention, during which he was reportedly tortured. We urge the government of the Gambia to promptly locate Mr. Cisse, return him to his family and loved ones, investigate the circumstances of his previous abduction and detention, and hold accountable any individuals found to be responsible for violating Mr. Cisse's rights. The United States is committed to supporting freedom of expression and the rule of law, and takes very seriously this and other reports of abusive conduct by Gambian security forces.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.